Hello, welcome to Profiles. I'm Christina Kuzmich, and our guest today is Deborah Kent. She's president of Pets Alive. And many of you also know her through her work with Wonderlab Children's Museum, which recently moved into a new facility in downtown Bloomington. Deb Kent is also an author and has written in women's magazines such as Red Book, Family Circle, McCall's, and Cosmopolitan. For several years, she also hosted a program on WFHB called Conversations, in which she interviewed nationally renowned experts in various popular fields. But to her national audience, she is perhaps best known for her provocative online novel, The Diary of V. Deb, welcome to Profiles.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Let's begin with your latest project, the one that we know right now, Pets Alive. Tell us about the program and how you got involved in it.
Well, Pets Alive emerged locally to address what I could only call a catastrophe. At the Bloomington Animal Shelter, 3 out of 4 shelter pets were being euthanized. They were, you know, coming in one door and leaving by way of the incinerator. And it was accepted in the culture of the shelter that this was simply the way it was going to be. There were really no programs designed to aggressively move those animals out into loving new homes. And Pets Alive emerged specifically to address that awful situation. I was invited to one meeting. I remember it was a meeting at Borders. I was involved in another project in town, and I thought, I'll just go, I'll show up. I think they wanted me there really to talk, to get my insights as somebody who had been involved with Wonderlab, because they were just getting started. And at the time, it was 3 women, all of whom shared the same veterinarian. So this veterinarian in town knew of their concerns about euthanasia, spay-neuter, or the lack of effective spay-neuter in our community, and the animal shelter conditions. So these 3 women got together. It's Carla Kamstra, Teresa Block, and Katrina Sturgeon. They had a meeting at Borders where they invited a few more people, and I went to the first event, and that first event was an Adopt-a-Pet event at the Kroger in Seminary Square. And after that event, one of the dogs who had been featured there was euthanized. We had the event over the weekend, and on Monday he was dead. And this is after several families had expressed an interest in him. And I'll never forget when Carla Kamstra called me and said, Boomer was killed. I just burst into tears. I literally started crying on the phone, and I had spent some time with that dog. In fact, I have a distinct memory of the look on the dog's face as he was in the back seat of a car being driven back to the shelter by one of the shelter volunteers. And you know how some dogs get in cars? They just love it. My dogs love to drive in cars, so he was happy as can be. And that was the last time I saw that dog's face. And I still think about it. And in certain moments, I could cry thinking about it because I really believe that he was a precious animal and he deserved to live. And there was really no good reason for him to be euthanized. So after that phone call, I just knew I had to stay involved. Mm-hmm. I couldn't turn back. It was really unlike any other volunteer work or any other work I had ever done, in the sense that I felt such an obligation to stay involved until, at least until, major changes were made so that things like that simply wouldn't happen again. And it felt unlike anything I had ever done. It felt like a mission, and it felt like a calling.
This was the Boomer that was featured in the Herald Times, isn't it? There was a story written about
it. That's right. Yeah. And some of us continue. I mean, it's interesting to see the different ways in which his death inspired our group. I painted a painting of him. And wherever we go, whatever storefront we're operating out of, that painting is always up front. And it's an acrylic painting of a puppy named Boomer. And Carla Kamstra has a picture of Boomer on her desktop of her computer. And it was really his death that energized us. If we weren't sure where we were going to go as a group until that point, everything became crystallized after that point. So as sad as his death was in some ways, he didn't die in vain, because really Pets Alive was very energized after after he was euthanized.
Mm-hmm. After this one incident.
After this one incident. And he was one out of thousands of animals that get euthanized. So theoretically, he shouldn't have had that great an impact. But in this case, he did.
Mm-hmm. Now, here you were, several of you with enthusiastic followers. What was the next step to get this organization moving?
I guess unlike other groups that I've been involved with, because this group was so new and there was so much work to be done, what emerged immediately were programs. It mm-hmm. was it's a very solution-oriented organization. We saw the problems and we developed programs to address specific problems. The first program that we felt was necessary to develop had to be a spay-neuter program, and not just once a year or once a month, but something that could be accessible to everybody on a regular basis. And more specifically, there needed to be some way of making sure that no animal left the shelter intact, that it had to be spayed or neutered before it left the shelter. So that was absolutely first on our list. The Adopt-A-Pets that we did, we started out at the old Ben Franklin store, and they were so successful that we had shelter staff and volunteers coming to us with tears in their eyes, thanking us, saying, "You're our angels. You can't imagine what it's been like this week in clinic," which is where the animals are euthanized. They call it the clinic, mm-hmm. ironically. "You have to keep doing this Adopt-A-Pet. You can't stop," even though our mission was spay-neuter. So now we had two programs. We had to figure out spay-neuter, and we had to continue Adopt-A-Pet because there were tangible, measurable results at the shelter. Mm-hmm. Fewer dogs and cats were being killed. It's as simple as that. And almost immediately, we came up with programs that would get animals out of the shelter alive. So we came up with a foster care program. And the shelter had not done that before, so that people could foster animals if they weren't ready for a lifetime commitment. It gets them right out of the shelter, opens up kennel space, because the lack of space was really the number one reason mm-hmm. why animals are being put down. You run out of space, so you have to start eliminating some pets. That's just the way it goes, and it can be the most adorable dog in the world. If you're out of space and that dog has been there a while, that dog has to be put down, and same for cats. So the foster care program immediately started getting animals out and into foster homes until they could be placed into permanent homes. The matchmaking program was another one, and that one came to me because I had lost my standard poodle. I had a standard poodle who died about 3 years ago named Chelsea, and after she died, I called the shelter and asked if they could let me know if another standard came in, because I missed her so much and I just wanted to fill the Chelsea void. And I was told that would be impossible. They simply didn't have the resources to contact everybody who was looking for a particular breed. And so we offered to establish that program for them. So we have this matchmaking program. People kind of register their pet preferences, and then we let them know when we have found a match. And a lot of people register particular breeds, but I'm hoping that people will think of us more as like a personality matching. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking for a fat, lazy couch potato, we can help you, or a jogging partner. It seems like a lot of people are looking for miniature poodles and chihuahuas, a lot of small dogs, and we can help them there too, but those don't show up at the shelter as frequently as the fat, lazy couch potatoes and the jogging partners. And that's been pretty successful. We've made a few successful matches. One of our critical programs is the Angel program, and that program is in response to an immediate need. It's designed so that a dog can be, or cat, can be saved from the brink of euthanasia. And when I say the brink, I mean literally when they are on that table in clinic about to be euthanized. If you see a dog or a cat that you like and that you would love to adopt, but maybe the time isn't right, maybe you were thinking spring, not fall. However, if you knew that that animal was going to be put down, you would take it in a heartbeat. And many of us have found ourselves in that situation. Now's not a great time, but if you're going to kill it, I'll take it. Just call me. Mm-hmm. That's the Angel program. You sign up to be an animal's angel, and if it comes to pass that that animal is on the brink of euthanasia, you will receive a call.
That nobody else has adopted it.
That no one else has adopted.
So you're kind of the backup.
We're the backup. And we have saved animals from euthanasia that way. And I think that that's very important. Another program that Pets Alive does is the puppy train. And we figured out that of all our programs, this one is the most successful in the sense that it saves the most number of lives in the shortest period of time with the fewest volunteers. So using that calculus, it is definitely the most successful program we have. And the way that works is we rent a van and we drive a whole bunch of shelter pets to Wisconsin. Why Wisconsin? It's Wisconsin Humane. Mm-hmm. And Wisconsin, apparently, has such a great spay-neuter program that they have a shortage of puppies. I find that mind-boggling, but it's true. They have 4 veterinarians on staff. The shipment, so to speak, of puppies comes in. Within 48 hours of arriving at Wisconsin Humane, these dogs are either spayed or neutered, and they're adopted within 48 hours. Mm-hmm. 95% of them, 95 to 99% of them are adopted within 2 days, which is amazing. And we can send between, say, 25 and 35 puppies and dogs up to a year old this way. And we go about once a week. So if we're looking for a very quick, effective way to open up kennel space at the Bloomington shelter and at other shelters, this is definitely, it's definitely the way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Why Wisconsin and not Indiana? What does Wisconsin have that Indiana doesn't have?
It's their spay-neuter program. Wisconsin's spay-neuter program is unbelievably effective.
And is that legislated?
Yes, it is.
Now, you found a community need. You identified 2 or 3 different ways of solving that need. Mm-hmm. What do you do about funding?
Well, good question. Up till now, we've really focused on life-saving as opposed to fundraising. It's really a triage situation. You know, if there's a tornado, if there's some natural disaster, people are going to help. They're mm-hmm. going to be in rescue mode. They're going to be in triage mode. They're not necessarily at the moment going to be looking to raise money. Now that the situation at the shelter has stabilized, thanks to our programs and the willingness of new leadership at the Bloomington shelter, mm-hmm. which is critical to our success and the success of these animals finding homes, now we're ready to raise money. And we have a very modest budget. We're not looking to raise a huge amount. We need to just cover our operating expenses. And we have no paid staff. We're all volunteers. We have a board of 9, and we have about 420 volunteers. So we'll be reaching out to public, mm-hmm. private citizens, people who love animals, people who've been touched by our programs. And those are people all over the country because one of our programs is Pet Finder, which is a national website. Mm-hmm. People come from all over the Midwest to adopt shelter pets. And that's significant given the fact that in the past, the Bloomington shelter did not allow out-of-county adoptions, let alone out-of-state. And now people have come from Missouri, Chicago, Wisconsin, Cincinnati. They've come from everywhere to Bloomington to get our dogs. Mm-hmm. And I find that amazing. I mean, I just think that's incredible. And that's our Pet Finder site, which is brand new. So I guess what I'm saying is that when it comes time to raise money, we will certainly be looking at our local community. But we're fortunate in that we can reach out beyond the community to all over the Midwest where people, specifically to those people who've adopted through Pets Alive's mm-hmm. Pet Finder website.
Mm-hmm. Now, for the sake of anyone who wants to volunteer for your organization or wants to make a donation, is there an address, a mm-hmm. website?
Absolutely. Well, if you're interested in just learning more about what we're about, I would go to petsalive.petfinder.com. And if you want to email us, you can email us at bloomingtonpetsalive@yahoo.com.
So that Bloomington, do that one more time.
BloomingtonPetsAlive@yahoo.com. Bloomington Pets Alive is all one word.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a wonderful program. It certainly has been featured in the paper so often, and it's the program that everyone's talking about. Who does your publicity for you? Because I notice you have all these signs out.
I do the media publicity, and Carla Kamstra has done the sign publicity. Stacy Conlin is a board member, and she does our flyers. So, you know, we try to attack it on every front, wherever we can get the word out.
Deb, Pets Alive is your latest successful endeavor, but you're also associated with another successful endeavor. You were the founder of Wonder Lab. Tell us how that came about.
The idea for Wonder Lab came on a trip with my family to the Chicago Children's Museum. My son was 7, my daughter was 2. My husband was sprawled on the floor, exhausted from the drive to Chicago. He was so tired from the drive, and I remember he looked up at me and he said, "Do we have to come to Chicago every time we want to go to a museum like this?" Of course, the Indianapolis Children's Museum is only an hour away. There was something about the Chicago Children's Museum that we really enjoyed, maybe because it was not enormous, and the Indianapolis Museum felt so big to us, and this was seemed much more manageable, except for the fact that you had to drive to Chicago to get there. And he said, "Oh, why can't there be something like this in Bloomington?" And I thought, well, why not? Why can't there be? Now, I really need to put this in context because I think it's important. At the time, I had my show on WFHB. Mm-hmm. I had been doing it for 3 months. And I remember being really impressed by the fact that it was primarily a volunteer-run effort, that I lived in a city where volunteers could get together and say, "Let's make a radio station." And a few years later, there you have it. And working at WFHB made me believe that anything was possible in our city because we had such a wonderful resource pool. Mm-hmm. We had wonderfully talented people with energy and, I should say, more disposable time than people in New York, where I'm from. We lived at a more leisurely pace so that we could make time in our lives for volunteer projects. You know, I don't believe something like that could have happened in New York as easily. Mm-hmm. That Monday, I started to make some phone calls to see if there was any interest. I called a few of my friends, people that I knew had some interest in museums, people who had traveled to other cities to visit museums, mostly parents with children. And sure enough, I got a great response. People said, "Yeah, that's a great idea. I think we should work on that." And from those initial conversations came the first steering committee, which evolved into the first board of directors. We became a nonprofit group thanks to the person who is now mayor, Mayor John Fernandez. He was an attorney at the time, and his firm took us on pro bono. So that's how we got our nonprofit status. And things moved pretty quickly. We went from that to a traveling museum. We had a huge event at the convention center. And then we were off. And then we had our first temporary site. We had that for 5 years. FHB and Wonder Lab and now Pets Alive and practically anything I've ever been involved in, all those things have one thing in common. They rely heavily on wonderful people, on talented, enthusiastic, smart, energetic people, and Bloomington has that in abundance, and I really think we're blessed to have that. And, you know, sometimes people ask me, "How did you do it?" Or, you know, "What is the special gift that you have to make things happen?" And I say, what I really have is the ability to identify really good people and convince them, sometimes against their better judgment, to be involved in these projects.
So that's your secret?
That is my secret.
You call yourself a social entrepreneur. What is that?
Well, that's not really something I go around calling myself, but for lack of a better expression, I do think I'm very entrepreneurial. I think I always have been. Even as a child, I was always thinking up businesses. But my entrepreneurial ideas don't go into money-making enterprises. They're really about things that communities can benefit from. And that's just the way it turned out. I always had a sense that that might be the case for me. I always had a sense that I'd be a writer for income, but my true passions would somehow be channeled into something for which I would make no money. I certainly don't think I would have been able to do as much as I've done without being married to a wonderful person who happens to be making money.
Mm-hmm. How did you become hooked on volunteerism? Is this something that was running in your family that you kind of picked up, or how did it begin?
Volunteerism was not anything that I learned from my family. I can't remember anyone in either my immediate family or my extended family doing any kind of volunteer work. But I did very early on. I volunteered for WBAI, which is a kind of the mother of all community radio stations in Manhattan. In high school, I volunteered for Planned Parenthood as part of the executive internship program. I was a writer for them. Really, every opportunity I've had, I always equate volunteerism with an opportunity to learn, to work and learn. And while I can't say that my family contributed to my enthusiasm about volunteering by being role models of volunteering, I can say that the work that I do is very much influenced by my family in a different way. And one way is that my father died when he was quite young. He was 41, really just hitting his prime in terms of his career. So when my father got sick, and certainly when he died, what I learned as a young person was that you can lose it in the blink of an eye. And life is very short. Life is very precious. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. And you better get to work.
You come from an unusual family. Your mother is from Cuba.
Yes, she is. I'm a first-generation American on my mother's side. My mother is Cuban. She emigrated with her family in 1956, just before Fidel Castro took power, and came here at age 19, got married to my father, who was American, almost immediately. They fell in love at the Automat, which was a cafeteria back then. I think it might still be around. And then 9 months later, there I was. So she was really a very young mom, didn't speak very much English. She probably was learning the language as I was learning the language.
So you had this multicultural background.
Absolutely. Actually, I have other layers of culture in my background. Her parents emigrated from Poland to flee Hitler. So my mother's parents and my great-grandparents are still buried in Cuba, but they all came from Poland to Cuba, from Cuba to the United States. And so I grew up hearing Yiddish and Polish and Spanish. And my grandfather had a store in the Lower East Side, which was very multicultural. And it was really, we lived in a very extended family environment. We lived in kind of a tenement apartment house in Brooklyn. And my father and mother and I lived in one apartment. And then just downstairs were my grandparents and my two aunts, who were younger than my mother. But we always hung out in my grandparents' apartment. So we were all really one big family. And sometimes I felt like one of the sisters, as opposed to my mother's daughter.
We're talking to Debra Kent, president of the board of directors of Pets Alive, and also founder of Bloomington's Wonder Lab. And in the next part of the program, we'll be meeting the other side of Debra Kent, the author of a wildly sexy and sizzling online saga called The Diary of V. We have a segue now. Deb, what would you like us to hear in this segue? What piece of music would you like to share with us?
I selected a song called By Way of Sorrow, recorded by Dar Williams.
Why did you select that?
Well, for one thing, it's a beautiful piece of music. I love it. When I hear it, it reminds me very much of the shelter animals that we help. The idea of the song is that you've come by way of sorrow. You've had sorrow in your life, but things really do get better. And the doors that were closed to you once are now open. And where there was the absence of love, there's now love. And whenever I hear it, I think about the animals that we've helped, who certainly many of whom have come by way of tremendous sorrow. And the song also means a lot to me personally, because when I look back on my life, there was sorrow. And yet I feel so blessed to be living in this town, to be married to a wonderful man, to have two children I love dearly. And it's inspiring to me to think that regardless of the sorrow in your life, there is always a second chance at a happy life.
Here's By Way of Sorrow by Dar Williams.
You've been taken by the wind. You have known the kiss of sorrow. Doors that would not take you in. Outcast and a stranger. You have come by way of sorrow. You have come by way of tears. But you'll reach your destiny. Meant to find you all these years. Meant to find you all these years. You have drunk a bitter wine. With none to be your comfort. You who once were left behind. Will be well.
That was By Way of Sorrow by Dar Williams. It's a selection that was chosen by our guest, Deborah Kent. Deb, in your other life, you're a writer. You've written for magazines such as Redbook, Family Circle, Cosmopolitan, among others. How did you get into writing?
Good question. Well, I went to Queens College, and Queens College had a writing program. Now, this was not like a school of journalism. This was writing, like, from haiku to advertising copy.
The real world of writing.
Well, if you consider haiku real, but it was like every kind of writing you can imagine. It wasn't exactly vocation oriented. And in my as I approached my senior year, I was convinced I would never get a job writing. I thought, I will never earn a living as a writer. What am I doing? So I became an education major and doubled and tripled my classes so that I can graduate on time with a degree. And I did my student teaching in the same New York City school that I had gone to as a student. It was Marie Curie Junior High School. And I did my student teaching, and I decided there is no way I'm going to go into teaching, at least not in the New York City public school system. I actually witnessed my old social studies teacher, Mr. Alterman, being assaulted while he and I were in conversation. That's how much the school system had changed. And this was a school in a nice neighborhood, but kids had just gotten rougher, wilder. It really was not for me. And furthermore, as a newly minted teacher, I wouldn't have been put in that school in my old neighborhood. I would have been sent to the roughest of rough neighborhoods, which is where they send all the newbies. And I really didn't think I was cut out for it. I had great ideas for teaching, and I loved kids. But I didn't like policing, and I felt that a large part of my job would be policing, and that really wasn't for me. So in a panic-stricken moment, I sent out 201 resumes to every possible writing job in New York City. I got interviewed from the middle of May till the middle of June, 7 job offers, and didn't want any of them. Because they were mainly secretarial jobs. I really wanted, I thought, you know, I could write. I think I could, if there's a way to earn a living writing, I'm pretty sure I could do it. I had confidence in my writing. I wound up answering a want ad, which, of course, never had occurred to me. Because I had no guidance. I had no career counselor, no mentors, nothing. I was really on my own. And I wound up answering a want ad for an executive editor job at a trade publication called LaBar Friedman. And they publish magazines like Chain Store Age, Supermarket News, Nation's Restaurant News. And I think it's important to note here that I didn't even balance my checkbook. I had never read an annual report. The idea of writing for a business magazine was a little frightening to me. On the other hand, they had something called an executive training program where they basically, if they selected you, you spent 9 months learning, and that I really liked. So I interviewed for the job. And I got it. And I wrote for all of those trade magazines. And then I moved to Fairchild. Fairchild publishes Women's Wear Daily and a lot of other well-known trade magazines. Between those two jobs, I wrote for trade magazines on staff for a total of 7 years. Mm-hmm. In my last job, with Fairchild, I worked for a very smart woman who told me, she said, "I'm just warning you, if you ever become pregnant, don't expect anybody here to pamper you." Because I was on that plane to the Houseware show in Chicago in my 9th month of pregnancy, and I gave birth to my son, and then I was back at work just like nothing ever happened, and I expect the same of you. And that conversation made me realize that I could not stay in that job, because while I wasn't about to have kids, I assumed that children would be in my future, and I wanted to have a balanced life, and already I was working 60 hours a week and traveling 75% of every month, and I was so tired and so overworked. So I went home and I told my husband, "I think I need to quit this job. I don't think I can have a life and continue this work." So we sat down and we came up with a budget and figured out exactly what the minimum amount of money I would need to make in order to, for us to stay afloat, combined with his salary, and decided, you know, I probably could freelance. So my first few freelance assignments were for other trade magazines, because that's where I felt comfortable. Mm-hmm. And I knew from experience that it was really hard to find good trade freelancers. And then a friend of a friend found out that I had quit my job. This particular woman was an editor at Mademoiselle. She, too, had come from the trades, so she probably had a lot of sympathy for me. And she called me and said, "I hear that you quit your job. I'd like you to write for us." And I was astounded, because I had never written for a newsstand magazine, never written for a women's magazine, and I was very intimidated by the prospect of it. And I tried to talk her out of giving me an assignment, and she had a lot of faith in me. She said, "Absolutely, you can do this." And I did my first piece for them, and it was on office romance. They liked it a lot. They gave me a contract to do 6 stories a year. That's a story every other month, which is a wonderful contract for a women's magazine. And because of the exposure I got, other editors saw my name and seemed to like my work, and they gave me assignments too. So that's really when my career took off. And from that point, I never had to solicit another assignment. I was a full-time freelance writer, and I didn't have to hustle.
Tell us about some of the people that you've interviewed for these magazine articles. Is there anyone who stands out as being very special?
The one interview that stands out was for an article I did on women who discovered they had cancer while they were pregnant. I did this piece for McCall's, and obviously it was a very heavy story, and I had to interview women who had been in very difficult circumstances. And one of the women I interviewed was a devout Catholic who had chosen to have an abortion because her doctor told her, if you continue the pregnancy, the hormones involved in creating this child will intensify and accelerate your cancer. It was a very difficult decision for her. She cried through the whole interview with me, understandably. But the reason why this really stands out isn't simply because of her story, but because she tried to back out of the article. She became very nervous that people in her family or her friends or her priest would be able to identify her. And I assured her that that was not possible, because we changed some aspects of her identity. For instance, she had an Italian name. I gave her a Polish name. She was from one part of the country. I put her clear on the other end of the country. I changed enough so that it would be impossible for her to be identified, but she was so concerned. And then we got a call from her lawyer threatening litigation. And as a writer, I didn't know whether the magazine would support me or not. I didn't know who takes the hit when things like this go to the courts. And I was really nervous that they would pursue it. But the lawyers with the magazine would not back down. They felt that we had done everything to protect her identity, and she was in the story, like it or not. And the story came out, and I never heard from her again. But I always felt badly, because I imagined that this whole situation kept her up at night, and I didn't want to be responsible for that.
You now have something very different that you're pursuing, the Diary of V. Tell us about that.
That's a funny story. My whole adult career, I've written nonfiction feature stories. And, you know, some of them have been pretty heavy. You know, women with breast cancer who are pregnant, heterosexual women with AIDS. I wrote a piece on multiple sclerosis and a woman who was going for a trial drug treatment. And then one day my editor, Redbook, who actually is now the editor of Cosmopolitan, she replaced Helen Gurley Brown, Kate White, called me and said, "Deb, we're starting a website." You know, this is how she talks in this very chatty, conspiratorial way. She says, "Redbook is starting a website, and I thought of you right away. I want you to do some kind of ongoing feature, you know, a serial, something every week." And I said, "You mean fiction?" And she said, "Yeah." I said, "I don't write fiction." And she said, "Oh, come on, you could write fiction." I said, "No, I can't." And I was really trying to talk her out of this because I think the last fiction piece I wrote was in fifth grade. She assured me that this was something I could handle, and she gave me absolutely no guidelines. I wanted to be about a woman. She should reflect the magazine's demographics. The magazine goes to married women. It's a magazine that we like to talk about sex, so there should be plenty of sex in it. You're on your own. I knew nothing else about this assignment, and I was very hesitant to take it, just like everything else in my life. Actually, when I look back at everything I've done, I think that hesitance always precedes my agreement to do something. So I said, "Fine, I'll do it. I'll give it a try." And I remember it was 350 words, and I decided to do a diary format. For some reason, I thought a diary would give me a little bit more creative latitude. And I, almost in the way that dreams form, there was some part of the subconscious that was developing this story. And for someone who's never done fiction, I mean, I really have no way of explaining how this came out, but I came up with a story of a woman who's a psychotherapist, who's married to a playwright, who is a philanderer of pathological proportions, who has one child. And that's as much as I came up with. And I just started this diary. And it was a weekly diary, as I said. And it was a 3-month contract. So it was the diary of V, and V stands for Valerie. Her name is Valerie Ryan. And I knew that I had a 3-month contract. So as I neared the end of my contract, I called my editor and I said, "So, shall I kill her off? You know, it's 3 months. Time to wrap up the story." And she said, "What, are you kidding? This is our most popular feature." And that was almost 6 years ago. So the Diary of V turned out to be this wonderful serial that everybody reads. There's a discussion board that goes with it. There are people who are completely addicted to it. If it doesn't come out on time, they protest. They go on board and say, I am paralyzed until the next installment comes out. There are people who have unplugged their phones to read 2.5 years' worth because it's all archived online. Mm-hmm. And I read these messages, and I have to say I'm just in shock because, number one, I never thought I would write fiction. I never thought I would write anything that would put them into a state of paralysis until the next installment came out. And until that point, everything I'd ever written had been fact-checked. Mm-hmm. You know, there are fact-checking departments at all the magazines that make sure that everything is accurate, and that's the way I like to work. And here I am being told that I can make stuff up. And it took me a full 1.5 years to 2 years to get comfortable with the fact that it was okay to lie. That basically I was lying, you know, 350 words worth of lies, and it was okay, and I was getting paid for it. And now I love it. I mean, it's been, as I said, almost 6 years, and I've really come to enjoy it.
And it's now in book form as well?
Right. Right around the 3-year mark, I found an agent. It was my husband's prodding. I have to say, I couldn't believe that I could write this online serial. So the idea of publishing it as a book was even more far-fetched. It would have never occurred to me to do that. But my husband had been reading over my shoulder one day, and he thought it could make a good book. So I contacted an agent, and by the following Monday, she had sold it to Warner Books as a 3-book trilogy. And then Warner contracted me to do 2 more books, not part of the V series, mm-hmm. but kind of along the same lines.
What is it about publications of this kind that appeal so much to women? There's such a large readership for this literature. What is it about them?
Well, women like romance novels because they provide a great escape. Mm-hmm. And the kind of books that I write have been categorized as edgy women's fiction. And they're sexy and they're funny, but they're not written about women in, you know, who meet mysterious strangers from France or, you know, are whisked off to castles somewhere in Scotland. It's not that kind of writing. I write about the things that many women confront in their daily lives, except one level above reality. The stories that I make up are often inspired by things that happen to me, but they're way more entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of sex and there's a lot of laughter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the people who read the kinds of books that I write are looking for that. They're looking to recognize themselves in a book.
Mm-hmm. You've been very successful at this. Are there any recommendations you would give to that first-time writer who's trying to break into the field?
I do get asked that question a lot. And the best advice I can offer is first begin with the knowledge that you're a good writer. If you're a good writer, meaning that somebody who knows about publishing has read your work and told you this could be published. If you're looking to go into magazines, my best advice is to be persistent, to know how to write a good proposal, and to realize something that I came to realize pretty early in my career, which is that if you're a really good writer, editors want to work with you. Don't procrastinate because you think you have no chance of breaking in. If you're a good magazine writer, you will break in, because editors are always looking for good writers.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as writing fiction, my suggestion would be to look at books that are in the genre that you're writing, open up to the acknowledgments, find the name of the agent who is being thanked in the acknowledgments, and contact that person. Go online, do a Google search of the agent's name, find their phone number, and contact them that way. Because if an agent has sold a book in a particular genre, they're likely to be able to sell another mm-hmm. one if it's good.
Mm-hmm.
That's my best advice.
It's excellent advice. We're talking to Deb Kent, and we'll take a segue here. What have you brought for us that you would like to share?
I brought a song called Green and Blue. It's from my all-time favorite CD, Comparsa, which is by a band called Deep Forest. And I picked this song because this is the one song, and actually the whole CD, I never get tired of. And if I were stranded on an island and could only have one CD, this would be it. I find the music very uplifting.
Here's Green and Blue.
Novel huma chikatelu Tena mian chin malake lake wa Ekana ngateo yibazana hu yeke ye ye Tena mian chin malake lake wa
That was Green and Blue by Deep Forest, and it's a selection that was picked by Deb Kent. She's our guest today. She's the president of Pets Alive, and she's also the founder of Wonder Lab. Deb, in addition to working as an author and also as a community activist, you're also a wife and a mother. How has your volunteer work affected your family life?
Starting an organization like Wonder Lab is a huge time commitment. It's a round-the-clock job, and there's a lot of pressure, and it does put a strain on a family. And there's a kind of bitter irony in that, because Wonder Lab, in a sense, was started for my kids and for all kids in the community. And I had this idea that, you know, within a year or two, we'd have this museum, and I'd be visiting as a parent, and it would be wonderful. And, of course, it doesn't work that way. And it took time away from my children, and it took time away from my family, and they had to be very patient as this thing got off the ground, and it really was a strain. On the other hand, now that it's done and we can all look at it with tremendous pride, if I had to go back and do it again, I would. the nice thing is that my daughter, who is now going to be 12, she was 2 at the Chicago Children's Museum. Here she is now, approaching her 12th birthday, and she is a volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives me tremendous pleasure to see my daughter volunteering there. Her name is Annalise. She's entering Jackson Creek Middle School, and she logged more volunteer hours than anybody else in her Girl Scout troop and won the presidential award.
So she takes after you.
Well, she takes, yes, to some extent she does. But I guess what I really want to say is that it makes me feel better when I think about how much work I've put into my volunteer projects. It also is some source of consolation to see that it's helped my children become volunteers. Annalise has volunteered for the Bloomington Playwrights Project when I was on the board there. She's a volunteer at Wonder Lab. She's been a volunteer at Pets Alive. And she really understands the importance of giving back to the community. And she has since she was quite young. My son has volunteered for Community Kitchen. He's also done volunteer sound work for the Bloomington Playwrights Project. So both of my children have learned that there can be tremendous value in working in a job for which there's no monetary compensation, but there's a lot of spiritual compensation. And also you're learning a lot. You're helping, you're giving back to the community.
Mm-hmm. You grew up in New York City. You moved to Bloomington, Indiana. What's the difference?
Well, I've lived in Bloomington for 16 years. I love it here. I can't imagine living anywhere else. The big difference for me between New York and Bloomington is that here, an ordinary citizen with a good idea can make something happen. And I don't think that was the case for me in New York, and I don't think it's the case for most New Yorkers, where you're so removed from the machinery of mm-hmm. the city that and so focused on just living your life, getting home, making dinner, making your train, raising your kids, the day-to-day. And in a town like Bloomington, you have more discretionary time, but you're also closer. I don't even like to use the word machinery. You're closer to the community. You're part of the community. You can meet community leaders. You can network. You can make things happen. You can make contact with donors and with the business community. In New York, those people like Donald Trump and Mayor Giuliani, I mean, they're celebrities. Here in Bloomington, there are people who care about this community just like you. If you have an idea, and it's a good idea, and you have other people who can support your idea, I believe you can make it happen.
Our guest today was Deborah Kent, writer, social activist, and someone many people in and around Indiana associate with Bloomington's Wonder Lab Museum, and now with the Pets Alive program. Deb, thanks for being our guest.
It's my pleasure.
What piece of music do you want to leave us with?
This is a song called Sophronia Bee, sung by Colin James. And it's a very special song to me because when my son was 5 years old and I was pregnant with my daughter, we used to listen to the song and we would dance around the living room. And actually, it was the three of us, considering the fact that I was pregnant with Annalise. Now my son is 17. And it's been a very long time since he and I have danced, and I can't imagine doing it anytime soon. So this song is very special to me because it reminds me of Adam when he was a little boy, and we had such a good time together back then.
Our guest has been Deborah Kent. For WFIU, I'm Christina Kuzmich. Thanks for listening.
Here, Sophronia, have you got a dollar on you in the state of California? If it's all right to know, I want a little girl to be on mine in the winter time. And when the rain starts raining, the snow starts snowing, reach out, turn on your radio. But look out, Jack, you better take it slow, cause the chicks are raring to go. Well, you reach under your bed, you grab a jug, take a little nip and get ready to mine. Look at your girl. You kiss her, then you send her, make a holler, I surrender, I surrender. Eyes are mugging, shut the liquor to me, John boy. Take a tip from me, she's sweet as my Sophronia Bee. Yeah!
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in July of 2003. Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash, Luann Johnson, research assistant. For WFIU, thanks for listening.